I got really stressed out about it. And then like, so I was selling investments and insurance and different things. And I've learned a lot actually from that experience that I apply to my writing, which I could talk about in a minute, but it makes you very entrepreneurial, to sink or swim. I mean, I wasn't, you know, like, wasn't like any close to destitute, but I really didn't want to fail and what didn't want to be a, like a kind of a screw up among my friends, you know, starting this failure of a career in my 30s. Like, what the hell are you doing, Fry? Like, so I guess it's just, you know, I beat myself up a lot about things that I couldn't do and then just said, well, you know, I'm gonna, I guess, go down in flames on this one if I can't figure it out. So eventually it came around. I built a book of business, and it's what I've taken from the business world that I apply to writing. Put it this way, when your job involves to some degree asking people for money to stick in a mutual fund or to sell stocks or to buy insurance or whatever, when you're writing, pitching an editor who might say no is no big deal. Like emailing somebody out of the blue for this, you know, publication you want to write for. I know a lot of writers who are good writers who are just like, oh, I don't feel comfortable, you know, pitching this thing or talking about myself. And I think, you know, that's completely the opposite of where I'm at.
Listen to the vibes.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Listen to the Vibes. And I'm very privileged to have Mr. Andy Fry here with me. From what I understand, you're a sports writer and you're an author. I believe the book is 90 Days in the 90s.
Yep.
Well, tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Well, first, excuse my winter hat. It's I'm in Chicago and it's 25 degrees here. So if I'm
Understood.
firing up the heat, it's a little cold in some parts just because I suppose I haven't gotten my winter game on yet. But yeah, my book is about, it's a time travel novel. It's basically about a record store owner who's, you know, about roughly my age now, late 40s, early, you know, maybe 50 or so, who time travels back to the 90s. If anybody's viewing this, they can see there's a poster for the basically the cover of the book behind me, and there's a what we call the L. It's a train. So the time travel mechanism is a kind of an urban legend, but there's this train line that takes people back to the past. And so in Chicago we have like the red line goes north and south, the blue line goes to the airport. And so I had to work with the few colors that were left and create something called the gray line, so that when Darby finds the gray line after kind of hearing about it for a long time, she just decides to go back to a certain point in the 90s to kind of fix some things or try to better her life. And then she just gets way too caught up in the music scene and, you know, her 20s and all the fun stuff that, you know, what I think nostalgia is a very American thing. I think we all think about, you know, back when I was this age or when, you know, a long time ago, this was great. Things were better. I think about the 20s being a time when I had no or little responsibility, and I got to go to, you know, see concerts and shows and do whatever I wanted. But I also kind of sometimes forget about the fact that, you know, I was rubbing nickels together, eating ramen noodles every night, and, you know, hauling my laundry down three flights of stairs to the bottom of the creepy apartment basement to that. We just tend to re remember the good stuff. And so I guess my novel's sort of a different spin on time travel in that it addresses that, and it both with music and pop culture, because I think music and TV and politics and all the stuff that happens in a certain time period, like a certain decade, they're all sort of can be used as devices to identify maybe who we were, what we were thinking back then. But also sometimes it's just fun to time travel and not be given the burden of preventing 9/11 or killing Hitler or saving your family or something like that. And I was just got the idea for the book was walking around one day when I was taking a break from working on my computer and was listening to some 90s playlists. And I thought, wouldn't it, you know, be cool to go back to see this concert, see these bands, you know? And I think about like what I would do if I went back in time. I would probably go back to like my favorite taco place that shut down, that just to get another bite there, or to go see a show that I maybe missed. I think about like James Brown opening up the House of Blues here in Chicago. I couldn't get tickets. Probably nobody I knew or hung out with could. But you know, if you could go back in time, you might do that instead of something, you know, supposedly more important, or you know, doing something less fun. And that's the basis of this novel.
So, do you have a train that goes back to the 70s? That's where I'd want to hang out.
Yeah. So when writing time travel, so I'm not really a sci-fi guy, and this is sci-fi light, if that. But you do have to kind of set some boundaries. So I just created the gray line. I kind of did some research on the Chicago Transit Authority, the CTA here, and found out that it was established in 1947. So, you know, I set some rules, and it basically goes back to basically 1947 when the trains were set up. And side note, you know, there's different opinions about whether like the War Department set it up to, you know, fight belligerents during World War II, or whether it was rogue scientists or whatever. But yeah, you definitely go back to the 70s. You basically would get on the Gray Line, I guess, maybe start it to the beginning, and you just got to get off on, if you want to go to 1977, you get off on that stop. And yeah, there's a couple of nuts and bolts to it. But yeah, there's definitely that possibility. So if I find it, it actually exists for real. We could set up a time, set up a trip to go see, I know, Led Zeppelin in concert before Bonham dies, if you want.
Oh, heck yeah. That was my favorite time, because that was my childhood, you know, hang out in the 70s again, watch $6 Million Man and
Chips,
all those good shows. Well, it's amazing, because I was having a conversation with someone the other day about music and how music just kind of can take you places in your mind. And I guess for you, it helped you to write this novel. So that's really cool, man.
Yeah, I mean, it took me 5 years to write this book, and it wasn't that I planned to take 5 years to do it. Or, I mean, I think when you're a writer, either professionally or even just like as a dabbler, you think, a lot of people think they have an idea for a book that they, you know, it takes some commitment to do it. But I guess because I like the subject so much, because I sort of had to create this time travel, this place in the 90s, I ended up basically creating the space in the 90s with these characters I wanted to hang out with. So I had to kind of sit at my desk and write for 2 to 3 hours a day to finish a chapter, to kind of figure out the plot, that I was just kind of going back and hanging out with my people, you know, in Chicago, 1996 and 1997. So that made it easy. I think anytime you write a book, you got to like it. You got to really want to jump into the topic whenever you can. Otherwise it's probably going to take a while to do it, or you may not see it through. So I was lucky in that, you know, the two things connected.
I don't think I want to go back to 96. I'd be changing diapers again.
Sleeping 2 hours a night.
Yeah, my youngest was born in 96. So let's see. My daughter was 92. Mm. My middle one, 95. And then the youngest, 96. So, yeah, I'm done with those days.
Yeah.
I got the grandkids living here. But, you know, I can pass him off to mama. So, but you're a sports writer. You still doing that?
Yeah, I write for Forbes about sports and sports business. Actually, just about an hour ago, I talked to, you know, we're in the middle of the World Cup, even though it's December. The U.S. pulled off a win against Iran. So I got to, this week, I got to talk to two soccer legends, actually not for the U.S. men, but the U.S. women's team. Just got off the horn with Brandi Chastain, who I've talked to a couple times before, and then Mia Hamm, I think, on Monday. So they're just kind of talking about the evolution of soccer as like a, you know, not just what's happening at the World Cup and what's happening with the men versus the women or vice versa. But, you know, I mostly do like Q&A style interviews where I'll just talk about what the athlete's doing, what's going on in the world, and then ask them a couple pointed questions, get their opinion about the sport or whatever the topic is. So I've been doing that with Forbes since about May of 2018. And then before that, I almost did 2 years with Rolling Stone covering not so much music, a little tiny bit of music, but mostly baseball and football. Got to interview Gronk, got to cover the World Series. And then before that, I was writing for ESPN, and it was sort of all over the place for 6 years. Everything from like pop culture and music to extreme sports. And originally, I think early on, I was doing high school football, like Southside Catholic League, where when ESPN Chicago had a prep blog here. So that was fun. And, you know, it's been a bunch of different things, and I get to experience a little bit of it all.
So you're just a sports fan in general, or do you have your preferences?
Yeah, I mean, I followed the NBA a lot less than I used to when I was basketball crazy in late high school or early college in 1991 or so, 91, 90, when my metabolism was like 85 times what it is now. I would literally grab a bucket of KFC and watch a day full of March Madness, and then I do it the next day. And I wouldn't gain any weight. You can do that when you're 20 years old. Yeah. Now, you know, now it's kind of a tough thing for me to sit through. I don't really want to waste my half my Sunday watching football. I mean, I grew up in Philly, so I watched some of the Eagles game Sunday night, but like I live in Chicago now. I've lived here since 94. The Bears are just, I'm not into the Bears enough. You know, I guess in terms of my family of origin to sit there and watch them grind out a loss every week, you know, scoring fewer than three touchdowns. But to answer your question, I'm more interested in the cultural aspects of sports. Like I always love reading sports articles in non-sports publications, because I always felt like it's not just about a quote or a touchdown score, but you get to cover things that I think are fascinating. Like, so to give you an example, like, if you're a Catholic school football player and you live in Nebraska, Idaho, Michigan, Florida, Texas, you know, Indiana, you probably want to go to Notre Dame and play for Notre Dame. It's just kind of a cultural thing that's always been around. But, you know, people don't go to USC because they're Methodists. It's just a really different thing. But they have this strange and very amped up rivalry, even if both the teams aren't in the top 10. I just think that that's kind of fascinating. And the whole Notre Dame thing reminds me of like my dad's generation. If you were an Italian American, same thing. You could live in the Seattle area, but you were a Yankees fan because of people like Joe DiMaggio and Phil Rizzuto, who played, you know, in the 40s and 50s and, you know, so, and Yogi Berra and, you know, players like that. So it, sometimes we ignore those cultural tie-ins with sports. I mean, ESPN E60 does some nice documentaries and 30 for 30, but I think on a daily basis, we kind of forget those little pieces. And I like to talk about those little pieces with athletes to get, you know, more out. Why are you playing this sport? And don't just tell me because you played in high school and, you know, therefore you wanted to go pro. Like there's usually more reasons to why people become athletic and take up sports as a, you know, a do or die hobby. So I'm fascinated with all that. But, you know, I keep abreast of what's going on day to day too.
Mm-hmm. Now, was writing a book something you've always wanted to do, or is that just came into your head that day?
I think it's always something I always wanted to do, but, you know, 10 years ago, I didn't, when I was writing, so what is 2022, when I was writing just kind of whatever I could for ESPN, I didn't have a really like an idea of what, I guess I thought I might write a book about sports. I may still do that. And there's a little bit of sports in 90 Days in the 90s because it takes place in Chicago. And there's the whole like Cubs sports culture that's ever present here, from lovable losers to World Series champs. Yeah, I guess I knew I always wanted to write a book. And then just like literally that one day in April around Easter weekend of 2017, I was walking around. I got this idea. I think I probably had the idea before, but I thought, oh, this would be great if I could go back to whatever band I was listening to. Was a 90s band, maybe a playlist. And I thought, wow, this is kind of an interesting idea. And I'm finding myself like on my phone, my crappy old Android that was falling apart at the time, taking notes. And I decided that I spent enough time on that afternoon. I thought, well, if I care about this in 2 weeks, I'm going to see if I can write a book. I don't know how to write a book, but I'm going to see if I could, because the plot seemed interesting to me. And it seems like time travel has been done a lot, but not really in the way I was thinking about it, and definitely not with such a heavy tie into the music. I mean, there's a few really good movies and books too, but like, if just think about movies, like that are all about the music scene, there's Singles. There's a little bit of that in Dazed and Confused, which I actually heavily influenced my book. And a handful of other movies that aren't documentaries, but there's not a lot of books on that where it's a fiction work. I guess like Almost Famous is another movie.
Oh yeah. Like that one.
Yeah. There's like some out there, but there's not as many as you, I mean, there's a million bazillion rom-coms, but how many, you know, books are dedicated and movies dedicated to a music scene? I just felt like Chicago needed that, and the 90s needed that. So yeah, book kind of was a byproduct of that.
Now, has writing always kind of been your niche?
I'm comedian David Race in Los Angeles. I host a celebrity-filled paranormal talk show like no other. Monstrosity has great guests answering weird questions. You won't believe the combo of celebrities and paranormal experts who've been on this show. I guarantee you'll like Monstrosity, or you get your time back. Go to monstrositypodcast.com right now and take a look.
I think so, but I wasn't really diligent about it till about 12, 13 years ago. I wrote my first quote unquote sports article in fourth grade when I think it was the summer, I think it was the winter of 82, and it was just snowed a ton. So we fourth grade recess was indoors. And I remember we just got hit with a chess craze in my my grade. Like there was mostly boys, but some girls were playing chess like nonstop every time, you know, 1 second after the recess bell goes on, we're getting out the chess board, we're playing, we're just crazy about it. And so I think maybe probably fourth grade was about the time when they say, you know, we've got a elementary school newspaper. If you want to write for the paper, write something. And I wrote an article called Chess Champs about the scene there. And then I kind of did that intermittently through high school and college, but I wasn't really a great student. I was kind of all over the place, you know, trying to have a good time and probably chasing girls and trying to pass my classes. And it wasn't really till the rise of social media and blogs and things were made more easy that I couldn't really ignore it anymore. And so I've only really been like a consistent writer, you know, maybe for the last 15 years, if that.
Well, whatever passion you have, I always say, go for it. Yep. And in that case, you know, there's somebody that's going to be listening to this or watching it and they want to go for something that they want to do, but they're reluctant. What advice would you give them?
You know, I just had a conversation earlier today with somebody. I got to interview Tom Brady in the beginning of this year, and I'm not bringing it up to brag about it. It was pretty amazing. I mean, I just got to talk to him on audio Zoom. But, like, we forget about – with the seven Super Bowls, we forget that he was, like, a third and sometimes a fourth-string quarterback in the NFL, mm-hmm. which think about third-string quarterbacks, maybe they go on to, you know, be a good broadcaster or something like that. Or, like, Pat McAfee was a punter, and now he's, like, one of the biggest – podcasters in the world right now. But you know, we tend to kind of write those people off. But obviously when Brady got a shot to be first team quarterback, I mean, he pretty much went to overdrive his whole career. And you can't really say that he was mediocre, had a bad year. So, I mean, I think about like, even if you like to paint or quilt or whatever the heck it is, or I don't know, make wooden, you know, pipes to smoke tobacco out of, like, just do it because it makes you happy and don't think about the money, because who knows where it can go. If you think, well, I don't really have time to, yeah, writing is tough in that you have to set aside time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to be a musician, you probably need to have an instrument or you better be able to sing. But, you know, if I think about that, I really started writing. So to get back to your last question, about 12, 13 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, I was writing on a blog, what became a blog, because I was working a 9-to-5 that was stressing me out and I needed something to kind of keep me sane. So I would rant about sports, and you know, when I'm working a Saturday at my office getting some work done and I just gotta kind of cash out of it, I put a little time into like just writing some sports thing that was on my mind. And you know, then I'd beg like 8 of my friends back home to read it and give me what their thoughts were, just to kind of comment. And it grew from there, just a hobby to kind of keep me sane. There's a lot of that going on. I mean, I can give you examples, but I think if there's something you want to do, you're passionate about it, it shouldn't be a question. I'll give you a perfect example with writing, at least. And I think this is counts towards everything else, that I don't think there's anybody who took up video games because they found out that, you know, some video gamer, you can make $5 million a year doing esports. Like most, probably 99.9% of everybody who plays video games start playing video games because they love it. They love sitting there, whether it's wasting time or playing with friends and being social. They do it because they love it. And then there's some who have gone on to be like professional video game players or esports players or whatever you want to call it. So I use that as an example. You know, in my generation, yours, you're maybe a little bit older than me. I grew up in the 80s. Video games are a waste of time. They're going to fry your brain. All you're doing is sitting in a room, clicking on this thing, and you're going to turn into a zombie. Yeah. I think we think of them differently now. And there's been some studies that say that video game playing can be productive for certain types of learning and this and that. But
yeah.
You know, for all the times that we were told it was a waste of time, and probably some kids in the 90s too, like people are still doing it because they love it. So I, you know, I'm not suggesting anybody go become a professional video game player unless they already play video games. They love it. And the point is that do something because you like it and you're passionate about it, and don't let the blinders go on just because, you know, it's not a real job or it's not something that your parents say that you should spend your time on. Cause I think life is to be enjoyed, and that's hobbies are part of it.
Yeah, I hear you. Did you get a lot of support when you got into writing?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. My wife and my kid was younger. I remember one time. So my kid's about 16 right now, and he, I think he said, I was between jobs, and which is kind of how it is in sales and technology. And I think I got a job, you know, like a month after he said this. But I remember he said to my wife, he said, "Mom, I don't think Dad wants to get a job. I think he just wants to write a book." So he noticed that. And you know, like when I was doing ESPN, 2011, the fall of 2011, I did the high school football thing. You know, it was like my kid was young enough that he was in bed at 8 p.m. My wife likes to, you know, drink some tea and go to bed early. So going out Friday night, you know, from 7 to 11 to punch out a 600-700 word game recap about high school football, even then I was only getting paid $50 a game then, you know, I got all kinds of support on that, and that was cool. So, and then kind of like when it became more professional, I guess my parents were a little bit more interested in it. I'm like, oh, so what are you doing? What are you working on? And yeah, it's, I don't know. I think if you're serious about anything, people can buy it. I mean, I guess if you want to be a professional Bigfoot hunter, there's going to be some people who think, yeah, what are you doing, man? Yeah. But there's going to be other people who think like, well, you know, as long as the person who's hunting Bigfoot isn't, you know, destroying their family or hurting anybody or scamming people for money, go enjoy it and, you know, report back the cool stuff you've done and things you've seen. I think most people who are worthwhile are going to be amenable to whatever your passion is, and no matter how, you know, silly it may sound.
Yeah, dude, I had family that was trying to push me into doing stuff I didn't want to do. And then when I finally got into working for the city, and it was in the water department, good job, good benefits, you know, good retirement, the whole nine yards. But after 20 years, I was getting kind of sick of it, and I wanted to get into doing something different. And I got that lecture of, you've already got a steady job and you've got all these benefits, why you want to give all that up? And I mean, I get it. You're looking to save for your future or whatever, that's good. But if you hate what you're doing, why stay in it? You know, it just seems like all the benefits wasn't worth it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Jeff Bezos or his cowboy hats, but I'm sure at some point someone said, you know, smart guy, why don't you get a job? Who's going to buy books off? What the hell is this internet? Who's going to buy books from a website? You know, what are you doing, man? Go get a real job. Like, I'm sure that it was said to him a number of times. I remember Senator Mark Warner, who's been a senator for a while from Virginia. He was like, he made his money. And I think he was like one of the first investors, developers in cell phone technology. I don't even remember which company it was. It was like way before AT&T and all those companies bought up the little ones. And I remember him saying, see him on TV years and years ago. He was like, people were saying to me like, Mark, get a real job. Like, whatever you're doing, you know, hot, you know, walkie talkies for your car. Who needs that? You know, so obviously I think he's worth, I don't know. I know he's worth the tens of millions of dollars, and he's done some good things subsequent to that. So obviously he did the right thing and didn't listen to the people who said, you know, get a real job. But I mean, at the same time, like getting a real job, just because you're like a postal worker doesn't mean you can't write poetry and paint. So I think about my friends who are my age or around my age who still bartend. Like when I was growing up in the 80s, my parents would be like, well, if you're, you know, you don't ever want to be a bartender because you're, that's means of kind of your, I think generationally people who are generation older than us think that like being a waiter, working at a bar, bartender is like the worst thing ever. That means you didn't make it in life. But I know people who like, you know, they love talking to people and they don't mind standing and they're great at shooting the breeze and, you know, they can make $500 a night. And they also like to wake up at, you know, 9 and drink coffee and have nothing to do until 3 in the afternoon. And that's their lifestyle and they enjoy it. So there's nothing wrong with that. And at the same time, if you're a bartender, it doesn't mean you can't, you know, work, do something that you love on the side. I used to work in Italian restaurants when I was in high school. And there's a guy named Keith who, kept talking about this thing that he was doing on the side. I was like, what are you talking about? While he's like making pasta and all this stuff. He's like, oh, so I get really busy around the holidays. I make, and this is like 1986. I make elaborate wooden trains. And then, so I basically like work my job. I come home, you know, wash up, work from like 1 to 5 in the morning building these trains. And then like he gets a ton of Christmas orders. You know, so he's like working his butt off from mid-October till January, clocking it out, making, you know, an extra 50% of his income, making these trains because people, they kind of, he had a reputation for making these cool toys that were ideal for Christmas if you're a train geek. And, you know, he was still working on the line in this Italian restaurant. I always thought that was amazing. I always remembered that. Like, he didn't say, well, I got a job already, I don't need to do this, or just punched it out for a couple months, did what he loved, and made a lot of money, I think, on the side doing it. So that's cool. You could do it however you do it. Just, you know, make some time for things that you like to do.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. My grandfather used to make wooden trains. That's that's kind of cool, man. Now, during your lifetime, I mean, we all go through hard times, but what's been the biggest hurdle in your life?
I don't know. I mean, I probably had a lot of little ones. I guess I don't tend to think, I don't want to say nothing, but I tend to not really think in terms of, well, I really overcame this obstacle to get where I am. I think, so when I was in sales, I remember the first, so this is probably going back almost 20 years, like, I was working for this financial firm. Things seemed to be going well, and I had like a month where like all my deals fell apart. Where it's like you gotta find new deals, and then you're 10 days away from getting fired. And I didn't want to be fired. You know, I suppose maybe I could have gone and said, "Well, I'll just do this in another company," or maybe this still isn't meant to be. But I got really stressed out about it, and then I was selling investments and insurance and different things, and I've learned a lot actually from that experience that I apply to my writing, which I could talk about in a minute, but it makes you very entrepreneurial, to sink or swim. I mean, I wasn't, you know, like, wasn't like any close to destitute, but I really didn't want to fail and didn't want to be a screw up among my friends, you know, starting this failure of a career in my 30s, like, what the hell are you doing, Fry? Like, so I guess it's just, you know, I beat myself up a lot about things that I couldn't do, and then just said, well, you know, I guess go down in flames on this one if I can't figure it out. So eventually came around, I built a book of business, and it's what I've taken from the business world that I apply to writing. Put it this way, when your job involves to some degree asking people for money to stick in a mutual fund or to sell stocks or to buy insurance or whatever, when you're writing, pitching an editor who might say no is no big deal. Like emailing somebody out of the blue for this, you know, publication you want to write for. I know a lot of writers who are good writers who are just like, oh, I don't feel comfortable, you know, pitching this thing or talking about myself. And I think, you know, that's completely the opposite of where I'm at. I got to write for Rolling Stone in part because sometimes writers, you know, freelance writers will trade contacts and will be like, I got this idea, do you know anybody at this publication? So I did that one time. And I basically pitched the Rolling Stone had a sports editor in 2016 who had just come on board from another sister publication. And the Cubs, you know, we knew if they weren't going to screw up, they'd probably win the World Series. So this is probably August of 2016. I emailed the new sports editor at Rolling Stone, who's a Cubs fan from Chicago, and I'm a Cubs fan from Chicago, and I want to talk about baseball. And he turned down my initial idea, but he's like, well, I want to do something about this, so let's throw around some ideas. You know, I didn't think that I had bagged it. And then, you know, 6 weeks later, I had my first piece in Rolling Stone. I actually interviewed Frankie Lindor, who's playing for the Indians, who basically took them through the postseason with the way he played, and then the Indians were in the World Series. So it was funny the way that it worked out. He was this new kid on the block who kept hitting game-winning RBIs and stuff like that, and he was super cool and super chill. And, you know, I wouldn't have got that opportunity had I thought, well, I don't really know anybody here, and I'm not really comfortable, and maybe they won't want to, they'll never respond to me. Like, you got to just take chances, I think. So those maybe obstacles I had in the business world or career wise working for all these, I mean, I've been laid off and fired from more jobs than you've probably ever had in your life. That's one thing, but I don't let it beat me up. It's more like, that's kind of a funny thing about my career, is that I keep getting thrown out the door, and then I end up doing something a little bit better than what I did before. Take life lessons from your screw ups and, you know, obviously don't hurt anybody along the way, but you can take your screw ups and kind of turn them around and use them as a tool to get what you want the next time around. So
is failure like your biggest fear?
I don't think of it anymore. I mean, failure is more like, I think to me, complacency is my biggest fear. So I just turned 50 in April and I just published my first book. So I'm thinking like, well, if I live a really healthy life, I probably got 35 years left. If I really, you know, maybe 40, how many books can I get? What else do I want to do in that time span? Cause I'm not, it's for me, it's not sitting around watching TV or taking a year off to find myself. It's more like, what else can I do that I want to do? And then fear doesn't really play into it. Fear of failure is kind of, I'm so past that because of how many jobs I've gone through. And, you know, I guess at my age, you're supposed to be a vice president of the company or a CEO of a company somewhere. Obviously I didn't do a good job of that. So if I was to get hung up on that piece of it, I'd be screwed all around. So yeah, just feel your complacency. I don't want to waste time. I'm pretty good at like hanging out and doing nothing for a day, but there's a lot of things I want to do, I guess. So this book was the first piece of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's your process for writing?
It used to be I'd write every night at nighttime, and now I don't even write at night anymore. It's kind of more project by project. I think because once I kind of got thrown out of the business world, and it took me a year, but I got my first contract writing job, contract for a big firm that makes corporate swag. And I was doing their email newsletters to their resellers. I was doing like corporate, you know, like blogs, but about the business, but trying to make it relatable and readable. So you're talking about trinkets like this Winston Churchill, this paperweight. Like, yeah, I would talk about like the inspirational quotes you could put on swag, not, you know, what plastics they're made out of. So it's just you just got to do, just kind of like, I think work can be a means to an end, but I think at the same time, you got to try to enjoy what you're doing and put a little of your personality in there. So that's, I think, what I did. And who knows? I think it's worked out.
I don't know how many interviews you do, but is there anything in particular that you want to talk about that you never get to?
Not really, because with the athletes that I get to talk to, whether it's, you know, like a sprinter that you're not familiar with, or I've talked to Lindsay Vonn a couple of times about her businesses, mostly like post-retirement. They know that I'm not Dan Patrick, and I'm not, Scott Van Pelt. I'm just kind of some nobody who gets to do cool stuff. So I want to talk to them just on a person-to-person level. I never get nosy. I'm not going to be like, hey, Lindsay Vonn, who are you dating? Like, I'm not interested in that. I'm sure she wouldn't tell me. I'm not going to ask Gronk. I think we all know Gronk is a girlfriend, but like, that's TMZ's job. That's not my job. So I just try to talk to them about what they're doing in life, talk about their sport and like what motivates them. And then kind of my main question I always go back to is like, what do you learn in the sports world that you apply to your business or what you're doing now? So I got to an email interview with Pac-Man, Manny Pacquiao, who was on the other side of the world. And we didn't talk on the phone. So an email questionnaire kind of worked out. I think I asked him 5 questions. So of course, the first thing I'm asking him is, what'd you learn from boxing and fighting that you use in politics? He's a politician in the Philippines. And that, just putting that question out there kind of makes me laugh, because we think of politics in terms of like a brawl now. So he answered it very matter of fact. And I didn't ask him if he was going to retire, because I knew he wouldn't answer that question. I think right before that, I just did a Google search on him. And it's like, yeah, Manny Pacquiao, the like headlines are not talking about retirement. So I'm not going to ask him, but he's not going to tell me. But he's pretty open about like just how he respects every competitor he comes up against in the ring and things he learned, and then also kind of how he relates the rigor of, you know, taking a punch in the face to being a politician and a business owner, and you know, in his, I want to say like his post-retirement life, because he's not retired, but his second half of his life, all things are related. So yeah, that's what I try to focus on, just like who the person is, what they've done so far, and how it all comes together with what they're doing now. And I think that's a safe and easy place to go, but it also yields pretty interesting answers when you let athletes just talk about what they like to do and what they're doing now.
And same question, but when somebody's interviewing you.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. It's like, I wrote a book because I found something I was passionate about that I wanted to kind of see if it, I could make a story of it. It's not because, you know, I don't have a master's in literature or any, I never actually took a writing course in college or even like from the local Discovery Center or whatever, you know, I just picked it up and figured I could do it too. And I just kind of keep it conversational and talk about my experiences and how, you know, like I talk a lot about pulp culture. So you live in Austin. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite movies from the 90s, but one of my favorite movies that I think is totally unique is Dazed and Confused. So when I was writing this book, I didn't think of it at first, but I think eventually I decided I wanted to take that sort of vibe where Pulp Fiction does it and Friday does it too, where the whole plot is that there's a little bit of a plot. It's not a massive plot, but you're basically, as the viewer, you're hanging out with those people, those mm-hmm. kids in Austin, Texas for a day. That's the experience. You're hanging out with them and you're doing the things that they're doing. And I wanted to see if I could apply that to my book. And that's, yeah, I've gotten some reviews on the book and they said, well, there's not really a strong plot here, but you get to experience the nostalgia. And that's really what I wanted to go for. Just people hanging out with Darby, my main character in the 90s, going to see, you know, bands play at local clubs and what it's like to hang out with their quirky friends. And then also, you know, if you could time travel, what kind of things might you think about in the back of your mind that you got to be mindful of? Like, I think so. I just try to take normal, relatable life and apply it to everything I'm doing. So when you ask me about my writing, it's basically me having conversations with people like I would on the street or, you know, across the street to my neighbor.
Well, you said that you really like to talk about music. So let's talk about music. So who is your favorite band?
Depends on what day you're asking, and I've got about 50 of them. But
you're like me.
Yeah, exactly. So I really love British music. That's kind of one of my, it's not a subgenre, but I mean, I love, the Beatles, obviously, and kind of the more late 70s Who. I like the Jam, a lot of the post-punk that came out. The Jam are amazing. And actually, like, the Police, their whole body of work is great, but when we think about Every Breath You Take, we kind of forget about the first, like, three albums and how punchy they were. And they're trying to do, like, the white guys who love reggae, who are from England. And I think back then nobody really thought, well, this sounds like white guys who are doing reggae, but the sound just worked. So when I get a real little bit nerdy about it, and maybe I've had a beer or two and I'm listening to the Police on my headphones, I actually listen to Stuart Copeland's drumming because I think he's as good as Neil Peart from Rush. And it's a very different style than Bonham from Led Zeppelin, who a lot of people say he's the best drummer of all time, or Keith Moon. But Stuart Copeland, like, technically, he's as gifted, if not more, than all those guys. And, there's something about the British Isles. I think that they just, I don't know if it's a complex or something. They just heard all this great music coming from the U.S., which I think a lot of times over the course of the last, especially in the 20th century, that some of these people didn't realize how great music was in the U.S., coming from the U.S. And then these British music fans are into 70s, 60s and 70s soul, or the fact that both Chrissie Hynde and Jimi Hendrix needed to go to England to start a music career boggles my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, America, what the hell are you thinking?
Right.
You're not giving these people record contracts. They got to go to London and hang out for a while. There's that whole, like, cultural piece of what happened in Britain that I think is fascinating. But I love second wave ska. I love trip hop and, you know, more like soft techno. I'm not really a dance club type of person, but there's a certain aspect to that type of music if you give it a listen, give it a chance. There's cool music in all genres and subgenres, and other than opera and like Celine Dion type dentist office pop, I pretty much like a little bit of everything, and I listen to a lot of everything. So. Depends on what I've got. A Tribe Called Quest. I've got a turntable mat here on my wall. They're probably my favorite hip hop artists because, you know, maybe I'm a little stuck in the 90s and I think they're underrated, and there's not too many artists that can take jazz, which is a body of music that not everybody is into, and make it rock, just like, you know, Dre did with the Chronic using funk. So yeah, it depends on how long you got and how many different directions you want to go on this.
I heard that. But hey, I didn't think anybody else listened to the Jam here in America. I thought I was the only other one.
Yeah, I got three of their discs in my car. One's a compilation, but I've got Setting Suns and what's the one with Pretty Green on it? Drawing a blank now. Yeah, I've got a lot of the Jam. I had tickets to see Paul Weller years and years ago, and then he had some legal troubles and he canceled the show. He hasn't come to Chicago or the U.S. really very much anymore, but I want to see him before he dies, that's for sure.
Yeah, I would love to get him on my show and pick his brain. I've got like In the City and Snap and a few others, but man, I love the Jam. And my cousins, they went to New Zealand, and one of the stops that they had made on the way was in the UK, and it's where he picked up the Jam and introduced it to me, and I fell in love with them right away.
Yeah,
but I'm like you. It depends on the day of the week and what mood I'm in, who my favorites are. Of course, I'm a huge Kiss fan. Love Zeppelin. You put on a classic rock channel, there's probably not too much that I don't like on there.
Yeah, there's I'm not a Kiss fan. I guess they don't really appeal to me. But there's a lot of, like, I think of how easy and simple and accessible the Steve Miller Band is, and then I think about bands that sound like the Steve Miller Band, like the 90s and 2000s band, the Donnas. To me, they sound like, you know, four girls in a band, but they sound like Kiss and Steve Miller to me. I'm just hearing like the riffs and a little bit of flair, but not too much. And obviously they don't paint their faces and, you know, wear like a leather on stage, but for as much as like they're supposed to be like the Runaways and girl punk, like to me, they sound like late 70s classic rock, just the way that maybe they've got a laid back approach to how they write songs and how they play music. But yeah, the Donnas to me sound just like Kiss and Steve Miller. So obviously there's more influence from those bands than we think. It's not just them influencing metal and, you know, 80s pop. Like there's bands, you know, removed 20 years, 30 years from them that are still learning from them. And I think some of that's coming back actually with some of the bands that aren't singer songwriters who are coming out now. I feel like there's more attention paid to, you know, bands that play guitar and write their own songs than there used to be, let's say 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. I've been interviewing a lot of people that do prog rock, mm-hmm. and I feel like there's like a comeback for that.
Mm-hmm.
At least I hope so. You know, you've got Yes and Pink Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
You can name probably 100 of them, but man, they, something about progressive rock that's, I mean, it's more, even though some of it might sound a little goofy, there's some sophistication to it.
Yeah, I think there's definitely more. I'd probably prefer more Rush and Pink Floyd than Emerson, Lake and Palmer or like a prog rock band from the 80s. I used to know somebody who told me that it looked like the lead singer of Marillion. And then I listened to Marillion. I'm like, God, I hate their music. But not really this on the creativity. It's just like prog. It wasn't even prog rock. It's like prog pop. I don't know. Kind of reminds me of a little when Axl, you know, was the only member of Guns N' Roses trying to do the techno thing about 20 years ago. It just didn't really work. And they got back to kind of their core. So, but people learn musical proficiency from the technical aspects of progressive rock. I mean, there's probably second to none in terms of a stomping around where you could learn and get acclimated to, you know, music that's not just two chords and a 4/4 beat. Like, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the 70s for sure.
Yeah. Did you get into the hair metal?
No, I mean, sometimes when I feel a little kitschy, I got a soft spot. I mean, I suppose my favorite hair metal band, if I had to pick one that I think is underrated, I think like Rat was underrated. Now, I've seen Stephen Percy been interviewed and he's like, we're just a pop band. You know, I was a pop band singer. I was just trying to get chicks or whatever he would say. Like, he doesn't really buy too much into his persona as like this visionary. And I think it's kind of cool. You know, I don't really, I guess as a punk and alternative fan, I don't look at Iron Maiden think like they suck, I don't want to hear their music, but it's just like not really where how my mind fits. Like Rime of the Ancient Mariner is not really the type of song I'd prefer to hear, like an early Jam tune or Sex Pistols. I don't think I'm a simplistic person, but there's my bandwidth is only so wide when it comes to a song. So, but I'm fascinated with what Iron Maiden has done in terms of like their, you know, their fan base. And I read an article years ago. I can't even find this magazine now about someone covered in like one of the artsy magazines, Black Iron Maiden fans. And they followed these two guys who were, I think from like Boston, who were at, I think, Roskilde or one of the German venues where, you know, like the Iron Maiden stage, like their stage is like the width of a football field, like that when they really turn it on. Mm-hmm. And they add that German guitarist, they've got like three guitarists, and they're profiling these guys who are just following Iron Maiden around Northern Europe. And I was like, wow, I had no idea that there's people who are other than like, I originally thought of Iron Maiden as like guys I went to school, had an older brother who was kind of an a-hole that drove a Chevy Nova, a really loud one, and I was afraid of them, and that's who listened to Iron Maiden. But I mean, I know science nerds who are into Iron Maiden. Like, yeah, they're definitely pervasive. Maybe that's not hair metal, but I mean, it's in the same stable. It's definitely for 1980s metal. It's got a lot more substance than obviously like Winger or White Lion or something like that. But yeah, I guess there's some. Because I'm curious, I keep learning about music. I keep finding bands that sound like bands that I know and like. Sometimes I've never heard of them. And I think in metal, I've noticed that if you, like in Chicago, you can go to see a metal band at a small club. And then if you do, it's definitely nothing like sitting in a you know, like a stadium venue in the 80s. And then the added bonus is that you find out how great the great musicianship that exists in metal. If you get to see a band at a club where there's 200, maybe 200, 300, 500 people at most can fit in this thing, then you're like, wow, I had no idea that metal guitarists had so much talent musically, because we're not really wired to think of them in that regard, other than maybe Iron Maiden and a few other, very few artists. So that's my long answer. So I guess metal blows my mind in terms of how much more is there than I thought was there when I was trying to get away from it as a high schooler in the late 80s, who was listening to the Smiths and Husker Du and Public Enemy, and I wasn't a metal person. Like, there's obviously something to be enjoyed there if you give it a chance.
Yeah, that was a head back in the day. And I've interviewed Billy Sheehan, Rudy Sarzo, and JJ French.
So, oh, wow. JJ French is like, I remember seeing him interviewed years ago, and he was, I think this is probably like 20 years ago on VH1. And he's like, his kids are making fun of the makeup he wore in Twisted Sister. He's like, well, I got to pay for your nursery school by wearing that makeup, so shut up, you know?
He's a cool character.
Wouldn't have looked at the guy and be like, oh, that's a dad with toddlers, you know, wearing the mirrored sunglasses and the death makeup, or even just like, he wore a lot of blush, but you know, they definitely stood out. We don't say Twisted Sister and hear somebody say, who's that? You know, everybody knows who Twisted Sister is. And they had a spot in the middle of it all.
I was impressed with the fact that he didn't drink or do drugs. He's a very smart guy, very business minded, and he's an author.
Yeah.
Wonderful guy.
Is he the one who's done, did he produce Seven Dust? Or there's a couple of bands I thought he was working with, and I'm dating myself here, but I feel like he had some kind of alternative metal type bands that he was working with in the late 90s, early 2000s. So maybe I'm got the bands wrong, but yeah, he seems like an innovative dude, not just a retired rocker who doesn't know what to do with himself now.
Oh yeah. He stays busy. That's for sure. Yeah, so what are your plans for the future? You're going to write another book?
Yeah, I've got a couple of ideas. I want to say I'm taking a break, but I'm not really taking a break. I'm kind of promoting this thing. And you know, some of it is, I live in Chicago, but I'm still in the process of trying to get Chicago to know I wrote a book about the Chicago music scene. So, you know, it takes a little bit of effort because I publish it independently, and just because you publish a book doesn't mean that people know about it all of a sudden. But yeah, I've got a couple ideas. I probably before I started writing '90s, I had a baseball idea where I'm knocking around that. And, I'm thinking if I can get motivated to write the baseball novel, which is actually it's not a new type of story, but it's about the first female player who might make it in Major League Baseball, and how would that work? Being like diehard into baseball as I am, I don't know. I think that I've had in my mind that I might start writing in December and see if I get a first draft done by opening day, you know, to pin it down to baseball. But yeah, I've got a couple ideas, and depending on what day it is, it's, you know, one of the ideas seems more plausible than the other, but I think I'm going to write another book. It's just, you know, when you take 5 years to write a book, you need a little bit of a breather and you want people to know about it. So I've just done promotion on 90 Days in the 90s right now, but I think pretty soon I'm going to kind of break the ice and start writing another story.
You're kind of hoping that's going to be your retirement plan?
I mean, to get back to one of the first questions you asked me, I don't even know if I think of it that way. I mean, yeah, I'd like to, you know, have gained some traction, not that I expect to be Tom Clancy or anything, but to write some books and to have a general interest. And I think when you're a new author, you know, nobody knows who you are, and unless you get the ideal book deal and you just write, you know, I don't know, like 50 Shades of Grey, you're writing what everybody wants to read or what the corporations want to push. It's a process. So, yeah, I'm not going to stop writing because, you know, when I'm 65, I'm going to retire, you know, like, you know, you can obviously write as long as you can think and tap a keyboard. It's not like digging ditches or working on the railroad. So I guess so. But I mean, I guess I'm going to keep writing because it's, again, like, it's like part of a hobby. It's something that I need to do. Just like if you play golf because you love golf, I guess you play golf until you can't stand and hold a swing of club anymore. Suppose if you are old enough that you are in a wheelchair, then you probably aren't golfing, but I don't know, maybe there's a wheelchair golf. I don't know. But I know some people will be swinging their golf club in their grave probably. So yeah, I'm just keep doing it regardless of what the shape of it is. It's just something I enjoy that I think keeps me sane too.
Now, do you have a website?
Yeah. So if anyone wants to check out the book or just find out about me, go to 90daysinthe90s.com. That's with the numbers. Or my book's pretty searchable on Amazon. So I always joke if people are buying light bulbs or Q-tips and they, you know, either for yourself or if you've got a music nut family member or friend that you got to buy a holiday gift for. Actually, the price is about to go down and my publisher is supposed to knock it down to $15.99 any day now. But yeah, you buy it on Amazon. Or I always tell people, like, if you got a local bookstore, locally owned bookstore, they probably don't have it in stock, but you know, you can order it. It's when you publish a book and you do it right, the distributors make it pretty easy for anybody to get your book. So if it's, you know, the mom and pop bookstore, definitely support them and order that or pick up a couple books from there, because I think it's important to support small businesses. Record stores and bookstores both. But yeah, it's out there. 90 Days in the 90s will kind of give you the glimpse. If you can't see, if you're just listening right now, you can see what the cover looks like. It's bright red. It's kind of comic booky. It's got some lightning bolts popping out of it. And the summary's on the back to talk about Darby, the record store owner, and sort of, you know, how and why she decides to travel back to the 90s and, you know, getting into the music scene knee deep.
Well, I'll put the link to your site in the description so people can click on it and go to it. But what about social media?
Yeah, on Twitter and Insta, I'm at Sporty Fry with an E. You know, most of my stuff is either about sports or music. And
thank you again. And any other books come out, man, let me know. I'd love to have you back on to talk about them.
Good deal. Well, if I'm in the Austin area, I'll drop you a line. I've never been there before, but it's definitely on my list. So thanks for having me on.
Oh, of course. We'd love to show you around.
Cool.
And I'd like to thank all of you out there. If you are new to the channel, thank you for stopping by. And I hope you'll come back. Please hit that subscribe button. For my regulars, well, I love y'all because it's because of you I get to do this. So until the next one, everyone, please take care. Be kind to one another. God bless and peace.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Listen to the Vibes. You can catch us on Buzzsprout or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and on YouTube. Follow us on Facebook at The Vibes Broadcast Network